In succession, O King, the great sage Narada instructed Srimad Bhagavatam under the unlimitedly powerful Vyasadeva, who meditated in devotional service upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, on the bank of the river Saraswati. Report by Srila Prabhupada. In the fifth chapter of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Narada instructed the great sage Vyasadeva as follows. Ato maha bhaga bhavana moga drik suchi shrava satya vato gita vata ulukrama syakila banda muktaye samadina nusmara sucheshita. A greatly fortunate, pious philosopher, your name and fame are universal, and you are fixed in the absolute truth, the spotless character, and infallible vision. I ask you to meditate upon the activities of the personality of Godhead, whose activities are unparalleled. So in the disciplic succession of the Brahma Sampradaya, the practice of yoga meditation is not neglected. But because the devotees are bhakti yogis, they do not undertake the trouble to meditate upon the impersonal Brahman. As indicated herein, they meditate on Brahma Paramam, or the Supreme Brahman. Brahman realization begins from the impersonal effulgence, but by further progress of such meditation, manifestation of the Supreme Soul, Paramatma realization, takes place. And progressing further, realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is fixed. Sri Narada Muni, as the spiritual master of Vyasadeva, knew very well the position of Vyasadeva, and thus he certified the quality of the Srila Vyasadeva as fixed in the absolute truth, the great vow, etc. Narada advised meditation upon the transcendental activities of the Lord. The personal Brahman has no activities, but the personality of Godhead has many activities, and all such activities are transcendental, without any tinge of material quality. If the activities of the Supreme Brahman were material activities, then Narada would not have advised Vyasadeva to meditate upon them. And the Param Brahma is Lord Sri Krishna, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. In the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna realized the factual position of Lord Krishna, he advised Lord Krishna in the following words: Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavan, Purusham Shashvatam Jivyam, Adi Devam Ajam Bhavan, Ahuspam Rishaya Sarve, Devarshir Naradasthita, Atito Devalogyasa, Svayam Shaiva Rahishine. Arjuna summarized the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita by his realization of Lord Sri Krishna, and thus said, "My dear personality of Godhead, you are the supreme absolute truth, the original person and eternal form of bliss and knowledge." And this is confirmed by Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasadeva. And above all, their personal self is also confirmed. When Vyasadeva fixed his mind in meditation, he did it in bhakti yoga trance, and actually saw the supreme person with Maya, the illusory energy, in contraposition. As we have discussed before, the Lord's Maya, or illusion, is also a representation, because Maya has no existence without the Lord. Darkness is not independent of light. Without light, no one can experience the contraposition of darkness. However, this Maya, or illusion, cannot overcome the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but stands apart from him, apashrayam. Therefore, perfection of meditation is realization of the personality of Godhead, along with his transcendental activities. Meditation on the impersonal Brahman is a troublesome business for the meditator, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 12.5. Plesho dikataras te sham abhyaktishat sucetatam. Om Mani Yantumaram Dasyajan Chakshu Kaya Chakshu Mani Tamiya Chakshu Guru Dhamma Chakshu Chaitanya Mano Bhutyam Sabhutyam 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 translation, in succession, O King, the great sage Narada instructed Srimad Bhagavatam under the unlimitedly powerful Vyasadeva, who meditated in devotional service upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, on the bank of the river Saraswati. So this is the Kachiplet succession. We find that Lord Brahma meditated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He did this on the basis of his intuitive knowledge and on the basis of hearing the command to Ha at the time when he was first bewildered upon waking up alone in the universe and wondering what his purpose was in existence. So, Brahma was the first person to, in the universe, to realize the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he came to that stage of attainment after a long period of meditation for thousands of celestial years. So, Brahma produced various suns, and thereby he populated the universe. He's the origin for all the bodies of living entities within the universe. And initially, since there was no question of reproduction in the sexual fashion, since he was alone, he produced sons by the power of his mind. So Brahma's mind was so powerful that he could visualize the form, and the form would actually be manifest, which is a little bit different from the situation of our minds. So, one of his sons was Narada Muni, and it is described here that he instructed the Srimad Bhagavatam to Narada Muni. And then later on, Narada instructed the Srimad Bhagavatam Vyasadeva. And Vyasadeva, in turn, instructed this knowledge to many different personalities who followed him, starting with his son, Shukadeva Goswami. And so the Bhagavatam is coming down to us. So this is the process of discipline succession, whereby knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is transmitted to people living in this material world. So the version that is presented here in the Srimad Bhagavatam is that knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead was always central in the affairs of the universe. Now this is a rather novel conception from the point of view of what is generally taught. Typically what you hear is that, well, historically speaking, primitive people worship the powers of nature, and they personify them by imagining that, you know, the thunder and lightning have a personality behind them and things of this nature. And so as a result, they began to worship many gods. But then in certain cultures, a more refined philosophical idea arose, and monotheism was introduced, which is the worship of one god. And this came about at a certain point in history. But here what we see is that monotheism, if one can use that term, was there right in the beginning. This was actually central. And furthermore, you see that the word monotheism can apply to quite a number of different concepts, including different impersonal conceptions of the Supreme. One speaks of the one God, but Brahman should be the one God. In fact, many people think of God in that way. When you speak of God, they think of some kind of impersonal absolute. So, it's interesting to see then that according to the description given here, understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead was there right in the beginning. And in fact, the process of creation was personal right from the beginning. So you start with Garbhodakshay Vishnu generating the form of Brahma. Then Brahma awakens to consciousness in this body that has been generated by Garbhodakshay Vishnu. And when Brahma was prepared through this process of meditation, then Lord Vishnu directly appeared before him, and he was able to directly receive instruction from him. So, as a result, information was transmitted to Brahman. So, the creation of the universe then involves two things. There's the adjustment of the material elements in the universe, and this ultimately involves the production of different living bodies. And then there's the transmission of instruction, which are then conceived by the living beings who inhabit those different material bodies, at least those bodies with a higher level of consciousness, which is suitable for receiving the instruction. So that is the arrangement of the universe. So one feature of this is the idea of information. There's a whole science called information theory, which basically came about after the invention of the telephone and the radio and so forth. Engineers dealt with the problem of how to deal with, how to quantify information. So a whole mathematical theory has been developed along those lines. Basically, that theory takes it for granted what information is, and it concerns itself with loss of information. In other words, if you send a message across some channel, such as a radio beam or a telephone line, then information can be lost due to static and different defects in the transmission. So information theory deals with the loss of information and how to minimize it. But there's no real definition of what information really is. And so I would suggest here that that is because information ultimately depends on personality. In other words, you can't have information unless you have persons who are communicating the information. So, therefore, to really understand what information is, you have to really understand what persons are. Because without persons, you can't have information. You can have marks on a piece of paper, for example. Like, you take one of these books. Let's say all the persons who are around disappear and cease to exist. The books are still there. Well, then you just have paper and little marks of ink on the paper, and that will last for some time and then gradually decay away. But you don't have information anymore because there are no persons around who understand it. So that's the basic thesis. So in the description given in the Bhagavatam, the concept is there that information about the absolute truth is being transmitted. And that comes from an original source. So the Bhagavatam is quite consistent because it's saying that original source is a person. That's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So from that original person, information is being transmitted to Brahma, and then it's being transmitted to Narada and Vyasadeva and so on. So now, another conception would be that the Supreme Absolute Truth is something impersonal. But then, where is the information going to come from? So, what is presented then with the problem that knowledge and information has to arise from something non-personal. And so how does that come about? It's a bit difficult to comprehend. This is especially true if you consider Brahman as opposed to be non-dual. There's no differentiation in Brahman. But we see that when information is transmitted, there are lots of words. For example, in the Bhagavatam, we have 18,000 shlokas. So that's a lot of words. So how does that fit in consistently with the idea that the absolute original source is non-dual, it has no variety in it. So you say that lots of words are coming out of something that has no variety in it. So how can that be? So it doesn't really make a great deal of sense. But the idea of the original Supreme Personality of Godhead is that, first of all, personality has variety. The original Supreme Personality of Godhead has oneness and variety simultaneously. That's the ultimate paradox. But that can nonetheless be accepted as an axiom describing the nature of the absolute truth. So, given that initial starting point, you have the information being transmitted to different personalities within the material world. So, one feature of information transmission is you have to have reliability in transmitting the information. This is where the modern information theory comes in, where they consider loss of information. So, and another feature is this whole emphasis on truth. You have to have truth in information transmission. Otherwise, the meaning becomes lost. So, the emphasis in the whole description of the disciplic succession is, first of all, that the personalities transmitting the information are totally truthful. So, Brahma is totally truthful, Narada also. Vyasadeva had the qualification that he was totally truthful. And so, therefore, he can transmit the information reliably. That's the basic conception. So the basic underlying principle of the disciplic succession is the information is transmitted in a very truthful way without being modified or twisted around in any way. As long as this takes place, then the disciplic succession can go on successfully. But as soon as duplicity is introduced into the system, then there's a problem. The real message becomes obscured. And then there's, of course, the question of trust. That comes in connection with transmission of information. If someone is transmitting information to you, then that means typically that they have something to tell you that you don't know. Because otherwise, why bother going through the exercise of transmitting information? If you already know, then you don't have to be told. There's no necessity for it. So, but then, if they're transmitting something to you that you don't know, that means you can't really check, at least fully, on what they're saying. Because after all, you don't know. So therefore, you have to be able to trust them. And if you don't trust them, then it doesn't matter if what they're telling you is 100% true, because you don't trust it. So it may be the truth, but it's all in vain at the point when trust is lost. So this is an essential feature, then, of the disciplic succession, is that there has to be the development of trust in the matter of transmitting information from one person to another. And, of course, the problem is that a certain amount of false information can cause an erosion of trust. So then, even if there's real information also being transmitted, then everything becomes lost. So the key feature, then, in the transmission of the disciplic succession is there has to be a very great emphasis on truth. So, of course, we see in the modern day and age that one of the problems with the acceptance of religion is that because, in fact, in many different traditions, there has been a lot of introduction of false ideas. Therefore, people cease to have trust in religious information generally. They tend to think that old scriptures and so forth are not to be trusted. And so, they turn away from all that information and try and figure things out by themselves. So that's one of the basic problems. So, in any case, we have this concept of the transmission of information by great personalities. Srila Prabhupada cites these verses from the Bhagavad Gita, which describe, well, Arjuna's realization of the supreme position of Krishna as the supreme personality of Godhead. And Arjuna cites the names of all these various great sages, Narada, Asita, Devala, Vyasadeva, and so forth, who have given this information about the supreme absolute truth. So, it's very interesting to consider what human society was like in the pre-Kali Yuga days. Instead, if you go back even to the time of Dwarpa Yuga, in those days you had a human society in which there were very great sages who were personally present in that human society. And these great sages had exceedingly long lifespans, great mystic powers and so forth. And they were understood to be completely truthful. That is, one could totally rely on what the great sages had to say. So you can see then the kind of stability that human society would have had. First of all, even the fact that people lived so much longer than they do now would indicate that the society was much different in its basic mode of functioning than what we have today. Because today people live for an extremely short time, and the result is that there's a lot of change that goes on in human society, because people don't perfectly learn from their elders, and generations are so short that change can quickly accumulate. You even see languages changing. For example, we're speaking English, but if you go back 1,000 years, English didn't exist as we know it today. The ancestor of English was, 1,000 years ago, you go back to 994 A.D., what were they speaking in England? It was a language called Anglo-Saxon, which is somewhat like German, you might say, but it's different from German also. If you heard that language, you couldn't understand it at all. So, in Dwapara Yuga, the lifespan of human beings was about 1,000 years. So just consider, for us, 1,000 years is a period in which the whole language can change totally. In Dwapara Yuga, it's just like the lifespan of one individual. So presumably in that time, language would not have changed perceptibly. So then, in addition to that factor, you have the presence of these great sages who typically, of course, for example, Narada Muni. Who knows how long Narada Muni lived? Actually, I don't know how long he lived. Certainly, probably for a complete kalpa, I would presume. He was born at the beginning of this kalpa, as the direct son of Narada, of Brahma. And then, of course, Vyasadeva is still living. The interesting point is that these sages are still there, but nowadays they don't come out into human society visibly, at least not generally speaking. Although we've heard that Narada Muni came to see Srila Prabhupada at one point. But certainly Vyasadeva, for example, was openly present in human society back in the time of Krishna's pastime. But those sages nowadays do not come out openly. Of course, our own particular simple succession is coming down to Madhvacharya, and the description is that Madhvacharya personally met Srila Vyasadeva, and that was around 10th century A.D., roughly about 1,000 years ago, a little bit less than that. So it is actually possible to meet Vyasadeva. But due to the situation of Kali Yuga, these stages generally aren't directly visible nowadays. So, in any case, any questions or comments? Yeah?
The first question is, you were making the point that information doesn't have meaning unless it's present.
Yeah.
So, that sounds a little bit like that point that allows the two worlds to fall into the one and the other and the same sound. You have information, there's no one there. Then you say there's no information. And sometimes in the future, someone comes by and all of a sudden the information is still there.
Well, I'm saying it's information in the context of the person who understands it. You could say that it's data or something like that, some other term, when nobody is there to read it. After all, this information in this book could be encoded in many different ways. For example, by arrangements of pebbles, or so many different ways of doing it. So, if you coded the Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of an arrangement of pebbles on a very large flat surface, then if nobody was there, you just had pebbles on the surface. And if somebody came and he didn't know the code, then you still just have pebbles, basically. But if somebody was able to understand the code, then he could read the Srimad Bhagavatam. And so then you would be getting that understanding. So, yeah?
I wonder if you might comment on some of the other ways in which information might be stored. For example, the inability to speak or to address the audience, the intentionality of the audience, the ability of the audience to have to hear what's going on, and how to stop that.
Yes. These are all seven factors involved in the transmission of information. Yes, because these factors are there, you have, I would suggest, the centralization of the key information. That is, the idea is to have a central repository from which the information can reliably radiate. Now, when it radiates out from that central repository, then naturally there are various defects which interfere. As you say, the speaker may not understand properly what he's saying, in which case there's going to be some distortion, and the people may not understand what he said. And plus, of course, it's a bit unpleasant if the speaker has some motive to actually distort what he's saying. And it becomes even worse if the motive is subconscious. And he doesn't even know that he's distorting it. So all these kinds of things can be there. So, since that's almost inevitable, because what are you going to do? People are imperfect. Therefore, the idea of the disciplic succession is you have a central source from which the information is radiated. And the ideal situation is, in the central source, you have truly reliable transmission. For example, Vyasadeva is highly qualified, a person with very elevated consciousness. So he'll properly understand what is being said, and he won't distort it. That's the idea. And so then this is transmitted to different great acharyas and so forth. However, inevitably you see distortion. So for example, Krishna said to Arjuna, when he was speaking the Bhagavad Gita, that the message of the Bhagavad Gita has been lost. So now I have to give you that message again. So these distorting factors are always operating. And it would appear that periodically that the whole message of the disciplic succession is lost in human society. Then it has to come down again from the central sources. So, some comments on that. Yeah?
You made the point that the mind is not fully often produce information on anything that deals with things coming to mind or like that. One might make the argument that just like you can have two liquids, and they're liquids, but when mixed, the solid precipitates out. So if the Brahman, within itself, as I said in the first idea, somehow or other, by interaction with itself, even though it's non-dual, out precipitates rather.
Well, you started with two liquids, though. So you started with duality. So, I'd like to see an example of that in which you start with one thing, truly one thing. And then to make it even worse, after all, the way chemists understand the way in which two liquids come together and the solid precipitates out is that they're
involved in the transition of information. Yes, because these factors are there, you have, I would suggest, the centralization of the received information. That is, the idea is to have a central repository for which the information can reliably be made. Now, if they leak out from that central repository, then naturally there are various defects which interfere. As you say, the speaker may not understand properly what he's saying, in which case there's going to be some distortion. And the people may not understand what he said. And plus, of course, it's a bit unpleasant if the speaker has some motive to actually distort what he's saying. And it becomes even worse if the motive is subconscious. And he doesn't even know that he's distorting it. So all these kinds of things can be there. So since that's almost inevitable, if what he's going to do if people are imperfect, therefore, the idea of the specific succession is to have a central source for which the information is radiated. And the ideal situation is, in the central source, you have truly reliable transmission. For example, the oxidase is highly qualified. Person
involved in the transmission of information. Yes, because these factors are there, you have, I would suggest, the centralization of the key information. That is, the idea is to have a central repository from which the information can reliably radiate. Now, when it radiates out from that central repository, then naturally there are various defects which interfere. As you say, the speaker may not understand properly what he's saying, in which case there's going to be some distortion, and the people may not understand what he said. And plus, of course, it's a bit unpleasant if the speaker has some motive to actually distort what he's saying. And it becomes even worse if the motive is subconscious. And he doesn't even know that he's distorting it. So all these kinds of things can be there. So since that's almost inevitable, because what are you going to do? People are imperfect. Therefore, the idea of the specific succession is you have a central source from which the information is radiated. And the ideal situation is, in the central source, you have truly reliable transmission. For example, the oxidase is highly qualified, a person with very elevated consciousness. So he'll properly understand what is being said, and he won't distort it. That's the idea. And so then this is transmitted to different great acharyas and so forth. However, inevitably you see distortion. So, for example, Krishna said to Arjuna when he was speaking the Bhagavad Gita that the message of the Bhagavad Gita has been lost, so now I have to give you that message again. So these distorting factors are always operating. And it would appear that periodically that the whole message of this different succession is lost in human society. Then it has to come down again from the central sources. So, comments on that. Yeah?
You make that the mind is not the rule of how to produce information or anything with that deals with any kind of morality like that. One might make the argument that just like you can have two liquids, and they're liquid, but when mixed, the solid precipitates out. So if the mind within itself, which is, I said, the perfect idea, somehow or other, by interaction in itself, even though it's non-dual, now precipitates duality.
Well, you started with two liquids, but you started with duality. So I'd like to see an example of that in which you start with one thing, truly one thing, and then make it even worse. After all, the way chemists understand the way in which two liquids come together in the solid precipitate time is that there are all these little molecules in there, and they hook up in certain ways. And that's even more duality, because you've got Avogadro's number. The number of molecules in, let us say, a few grams of substance would be about 6 times 10 to the 23rd power. That's a 6 followed by 23 zeros. So that's how many little atoms you've got in that amount of substance. So that's a lot of duality. So it would be nice to have a non-dual example. But I go further, though, because the scientists also have their own impersonal theory. And they're not against duality. They're the ones who propose that all these molecules are there. But they'll say, you start with the molecules all disconnected from each other, just sort of bumping into each other at random. And you let that go on for a while, under the right conditions. And then living cells come out, and then they grow and divide, and then an evolutionary process takes place, and they gradually turn into fish and lizards and finally monkeys, and then they stand upright and turn into people, and then we've got all this information. And Darwin rightly doubted. He said, I'm proposing this theory of evolution, but then I must consider that according to that same theory, my own mind is evolved from the mind of an ape. And how can one give any credence to the conclusions arrived at from such a mind? So, he considered that point. Darwin was quite perceptive in many ways. But, anyway, so how does the information come out of something impersonal? I think it's been explained. By the way, our concept of Brahman is not exactly that Brahman is non-dual, because it is the effulgence from the body of Krishna. So, and Brahman must also have variegation in it, the real Brahman, as opposed to the philosophical Brahman. Over to Prabhupada.